Ron Kronisch, the author and speaker tonight of The Other Peace Process, Interreligious Dialogue, A View from Jerusalem, is the founding director of the Interreligious Coordinating Council in Israel, where he has lived in Jerusalem for the past 37 years. Do I have that right? 37 now?
38 now.
38 now. He was educated with a BA at Brandeis. He has his rabbinic ordination from the Reform HUCJAR here in New York. And as I said, his doctorate from the Harvard Graduate School of Education in philosophy and history of education. Rabbi Kronisch blogs regularly for the Times of Israel and the Huffington Post. I read him frequently and always on point. And I'm going to say this my way, Ron. He is the proud father of a JTS graduate, Rabbi Dalia Kronisch, and two other children. And five grandchildren?
Very good.
So, good. When Ron has finished his talk, we are going to hear responses from two of New York's most inveterate, active, and engaged dialoguers. The Reverend Chloe Breyer, she's the woman in the collar. Chloe is the executive director of the Interfaith Center of New York. She joined the Interfaith Center in 2007, a decade now. Chloe's an Episcopal priest in the Diocese of New York and received her PhD in Christian ethics from the Union Theological Seminary. And she is also an author of a fascinating book called The Close, A Young Woman's First Year at Seminary. It's published by Basic Books. And if you want to know the scoop on what really happens at seminary, Chloe's book really tells it all. Her colleague and my colleague and friend, Iman Bukadun Esquire, is a social justice activist and, by her description, an Algerian-American Muslim woman. Her career began at the Office for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties at the Department of Homeland Security. Iman received her BA from University of Virginia, her law degree, her JD from the College of William & Mary School of Law, and she is the Director of Community Partnerships at the Interfaith Center of New York. So Ron's going to speak for a while, and then Chloe and Iman will respond, and then we'll have the opportunity for Q&A. When we have finished, Ron has graciously brought with him books for sale, not just for sale, at discount. Which I'm sure he will be happy to not only sell you, but sign them if you'd like. Rabbi Kronisch, if you please.
Thank you. Is this good enough where it is?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. I'll start standing up and we'll see how the evening goes. So, thank you, Bert. It's good to be back at JTS. I had the chance to do a lunch and learn with some of the students today as well, and been here several times over the years, often with Israeli Arab colleagues who I've traveled with, but this time I'm on my own, and I like coming to New York because I have a grandson up in Riverdale. So it's always a good occasion to be here. So 2 years ago I retired after working for 25 years as the director of an organization in Israel which did interreligious dialogue between members of two peoples and three religions. So the two peoples who are duking it out in our part of the world are the Jewish people, Israeli people, but the Jewish people, who through the Zionist movement and modern Jewish history established the Jewish state in the land of Israel, and the Palestinian people who live inside Israel, next door to Israel, and in Detroit and San Salvador and all around the world, are attempting, as another national group, to establish a state side by side with Israel and haven't achieved that a dream yet. These two peoples have, for the last, well, let's say 100 years or so, been struggling to figure out how to share the land. And so you can look at our conflict binationally or tri-religiously. So Jews as you know, our religious group, but they don't all agree. See, and so we have Reform and Conservative and Orthodox and Zionist and non-Zionist and all everything in between. And the Christians and the Muslims who are Palestinians also don't all agree. So we bring together, or we have brought together in the last 25 years in dialogue, Palestinians who are Muslim, largely Muslim, and minority Christian, in dialogue with Jews who in Israel are the majority, at least the majority of the citizens within the state of Israel, for interreligious dialogue. Okay. And several years ago, it's actually quite a while ago, in 1997, I published an op-ed in the Jerusalem Post about the work we were doing then, and the editor liked it, and he used the phrase I used at the end of the article, and he titled the article "The Other Peace Process," and it's a name I've been using ever since then. And I want to say a few words about what it is and what I think it means. Okay. So most people who follow Israel from abroad, whether it's New York or wherever, are fairly highly engaged in the political stuff. What the prime minister said yesterday, or at the UN, or here or there, what your president, who we sent to Israel to try to start the peace process, the political talks, that's lately Mr. Kushner and Jason, what's his name, Greenblatt, is that all right? So the general focus of concern, certainly I would say of American Jews, is on the political stuff. When will there be peace? And why isn't there peace yet? And what can we do to get the peace process moving faster, and so forth. So that is not my topic. And I know very little about it. I know a little bit about it because I live in Israel and I read the newspapers and I'm a newsaholic and every hour I listen to the news. But I'm not a political scientist. I'm not a Dennis Ross who's written about these things. I know only a little bit about it in the sense that I would make the case that wherever one does interreligious, intercultural, intergroup dialogue, the context of where you're doing it is very important. So if you're doing it if you did it, let's say, before it ended, in Northern Ireland, or in South Africa, or in Bosnia-Herzegovina, in places where there was a hot, long, violent conflict, it's one thing. If you're doing it in Northern California, it's another thing, okay? And if you're doing it in New York City, or Rome, or so, I argue that the context matters a lot, and so I need to say a few words about the context. Okay. So, we in Israel, or Israel and Palestine, are living in an ongoing conflict that, despite all the attempts of international diplomats and American president and so forth, is not getting resolved right away and does not look like it's going to be resolved in the very near future. Okay. There were higher hopes, maybe 20 years ago, 22 years ago, that we might actually resolve the conflict in the days of Prime Minister Rabin and the early years of the Oslo Accords. There was actually great euphoria in Israel that maybe this is all going to end. And that kind of lasted ups and downs until summer 2000 when Prime Minister Barak went to Camp David 2 outside of Washington. And I still remember that when he went, I don't know how many of you know, Prime Minister Barak was is a very smart individual. He was head of the army, he is great pianist, he makes watches, and he's kind of self-assured, it would be a good way, confident in himself. Is that all right? And when he went to, took up Clinton's offer to come to Camp David too, he and his advisors at the time thought that they could resolve all the outstanding issues, and they had talking points and papers and in their briefcases too, to finish it. And the headline in one of the newspapers in Israel, I remember vividly, said, "End of conflict insight." Okay. And that was the hope at the end of the decade of the 90s, that this conflict could be resolved. Since that time, as you know, we've pretty much gone downhill. And there is no end in sight for most people, although there are many plans and many ideas, of the political solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Therefore, that has left a lot of people with feelings of despair. I call it political despair, that they don't see any hope in their current political leadership. You wouldn't know anything about that here in this country, but in Israel we have this problem. And therefore, less people have placed confidence in the political processes. Okay. Side by side, or parallel to the development of the political peace processes of the 90s, they developed a movement in Israel, like in other countries, they went through similar things, which I call the other peace process. Other people call it people-to-people work, or tractate diplomacy, or I don't know, there are a few other names for it. The idea is that this work is not the work of politicians. I used to like to say politicians set up the framework, they build the house, but we have to furnish it with furniture and a good kitchen, you know, and a living room, and we have to eat and be able to schmooze and live together. Okay, so the we is everybody else, practically. It's rabbis and ministers and Muslim clergy, it's educators of all kinds, it's youth workers, it's social workers, it's everybody in this relatively large NGO world. And we have a large NGO world in Israel, of hundreds of organizations doing all kinds of things. It's the job of the rest of us to help people learn to live in peace together, or in peaceful relations together, for the long term, okay? And part of our job, I argue, is a little bit of seeing beyond the present moment. Because in the present moment, people are pretty depressed. You know, they just can't see the sunshine. And they can't believe that a solution is possible in the future somewhere, and they can't even see the benefits. Okay. So in our work in Israel, we work with Jews, Christians, and Muslims, youth, young adults, religious leaders, educators, all kinds of people. We brought them in for many years into long-term, sustained dialogue for a year, two, three, 4 years, where they would get to know one another, where they would learn a little bit about each other's religions, where they would discuss issues of the conflict in a way that they could listen to one another, hear often for the first time the other person's narrative, and think about ways that they could take some common action together, which, by the way, was always very difficult, because it's one thing to be in the cozy, well-facilitated bubble of dialogue. It's another thing to go face your community, which is kind of like questioning the worth of what you're doing in times of conflict and even wars. So after I finished doing all this work, I sat down and I wrote some thoughts down. And in the last chapter of my book, I talk about some of the lessons that I learned and some of my thoughts for the future. And I wanted to share three of them with you now and then open it up for response and questions and discussion, because despite the fact that I believe that what goes on in Israel is very particular to Israel, I've traveled the world, I've been to America many times, in Europe, and so I've met Burke many places in the world, and many of these things are in common. And I think some of the challenges that I will put forth to you today are challenges that we face in Israel, in New York, or in Europe, or other places in the world. Okay. So I will put out three. If you want to read it in depth, you can buy the book and read the last chapter, or you can just read the last chapter somehow. Okay, so I think there are three main directions as I reflect upon my career in this field the last 25 years. The first sounds a little mundane and boring. It's called education. Okay? So here's the story. Jews and Christians, for example, have been dialoguing for the last 50, 60 years already. And as a core of people who know everybody's documents and know what's going on, but the masses of Jews and Catholics and Protestants and Jews haven't really been engaged. Don't know what we're talking about. One of the most important things I think I did in my career was with my wife and some other people. We made a film called I Am Joseph, Your Brother, which was based on Pope John Paul's visit to Israel, historic visit in March 2000, because we wanted people around the world to know about the changes in Jewish-Catholic relations. And the film was on was produced for ABT Television and went all over the U.S. And so the first thing we still need to do is to continue to educate more broadly and more deeply, whether it's in seminaries or in schools or in teacher training. And there's many places where education about each other needs to go on, and we can't just drop it and say, okay, you know, the people at the top know the dialogue and everybody else is done, we can move on. So I don't think we can move on totally. So the work of education and expanding it and strengthening it and developing it, by the way, I might add, particularly in the Jewish community, which has been weaker in this area than other communities for reasons we can discuss. Okay. The second thing I think for me is an important challenge for the future is the idea of bringing Muslims into the dialogue. It sounds nice, it sounds right, I think, but it's very hard to do and very complicated. When I was in town last month, I attended a session that Professor Vitzatsky chaired across the street. There's a council of centers for Jewish-Christian relations in the U.S. now with 30, 32 centers, I think. And most of them are still Jewish-Christian. One or two have now, in a very thoughtful way, begun to integrate American Muslims into their work. And I think it's very important to do that. So why is it difficult? Well, I think some of the reasons you know. One is there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of Islamophobia in Israel and Europe and America. Some perhaps justified, but when you talk about a phobia, it means part of it is irrational. There's no tradition yet of Jewish Muslims are. The Jews and the Catholics have been doing this 50 years. We've got a culture of politeness there, we've got respect, we've got all kinds of kind of informal rules that have been established, and it kind of really works. Okay. So we're talking about a whole new thing. Thirdly, which Muslims are you going to talk to? See? So one of the things I've learned in my work in Israel too is that Muslims are very diverse. Sunni Shi'i within the Sunnis, there's Sufis, there's all kinds of Muslims. We, by the way, in Israel, were able to work with Israeli Arab Muslims in a very significant way, which is an interesting story. I'd be happy to share more with you if you want to know more about it. But I know when I meet people in this country and I get questions, you know, who are we going to talk to? And, oh, somebody said today at lunch, oh, we started one last year in San Francisco, but then something happened in Israel and we stopped because everybody was angry at one another, so we couldn't talk anymore. So I think this needs thought, how to do it, who to engage with, how to engage. But I would say that leaving Muslims out of the equation in today's world sounds a little, I would say, out of date, and kind of would make us in the field irrelevant. So I, particularly in my work in recent years, have spent much more time in the Jewish-Muslim dialogue than I have in the Jewish-Christian, but we did a lot of trialogue, bringing the three together all the time and seeing what we could do. Okay, and the third thing that I would like to share as a thought for the future, which I'm sure my respondents will have something to say about. I've had for a long time a kind of pet peeve about dialogue. Dialoguers, when they do it well, kind of really enjoy it. You know, it's kind of fun. You really learn, you meet other people. But we have this idea that dialogue should lead to action. And all too often it doesn't. And it kind of goes in circles and be, well, you know, I thought the purpose of the dialogue was just to meet other people. So, well, no, we said that the purpose of the dialogue was to train you to go out and make the world a little better. Keep going along. Oh, yeah, but that's another organization. That's somebody else. No, I'm serious. I used to have staff who would say, well, I'm an educator. I know how to facilitate dialogue. I'm an activist. That's the American Civil Liberties Union or the one in Israel that's like it. Okay, that's another act. And I've argued for years, no, we have to combine these two. And so just for the Jews in the room, I'm sure I would share that I've often met people from various churches, Catholic churches, Protestant churches, who have, they'll have a committee of people involved in the Jewish-Christian dialogue. That's one group of people. And they'll have another committee called the Justice and Peace Committee, and that's another group of people. And on issues of Israel-Palestine, they're usually not on the same side of the fence. And I've always said, how about a committee for dialogue for justice and peace? But it hasn't, I don't know if it's happened yet. So that's my suggestion, that we need to connect the interreligious dialogue from just an academic, intellectual exercise, or even a kind of psychological, social psychological exercise, to working together to deal with some of the burning issues that we face in the world, knowing that it's not always going to be that easy to find issues that we can cooperate on. Okay? And you have to look for the ones that speak to enough communities to say, okay, we've got a problem of housing, or we got a problem of poverty, can we deal on this together or not? And is it our responsibility as religious leaders, educators, and spiritual leaders to deal with? So that's my third pitch, connecting the dialogue, beyond the dialogue, to some action in the field. I begin to see some signs of it here and there, but I'd like to see a lot more. So those are my opening thoughts, and I'd be glad to hear the responses, and then we'll all engage together. All right.
Just a big thank you. Rabbi Kronisch doesn't remember, but I was a very entertained and happy guest at his home at one point a few years ago when we had an Indonesian-led Jewish, Christian, and Muslim delegation to learn about peace building and peace process in. So, and I do recall that your your temple was an absolute haven in what had otherwise been a rather sort of scary process, where we had left one delegate, never made it across from Jordan into Israel because, you know, the documents were wrong. Other places where we were in Dubai asked, you know, how many Jews are in your party? I mean, you know, lovely questions like that. So again, it was the work that you have done for so many years in Israel and the Palestinian territories and has really been just amazing. I wanted also to uphold in the book itself the emphasis that you place on the importance of intra-faith dialogue and the importance of entering into any dialogue with the curiosity about the differences that exist within the tradition, because that itself is a breakthrough moment once you figure out that we tend to sort of look at somebody who represents the other and think there is no diversity in their tradition like there is in mine. So I thought one thing I might, just to begin with your last question, about that, the importance of linking dialogue with action, and offering a kind of comparative point here in New York City, where, as Rabbi Vitsotsky mentioned, I direct something called the Interfaith Center of New York that has been around for about 20 years. And as our premise, we sort of began with the opposite idea, that actually it's easier to connect the two if you start with action, and then sort of in the coffee break, you kind of get to a bit of dialogue. So, we were begun, two decades ago by the former dean of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, who I don't think really know exactly what he wanted to do, but he wanted to do something interesting as it related to interfaith, and not just among the Abrahamics, but also a wider vision of really non-Abrahamic faiths as well, which is something that's pretty easy to do in New York. We figured out after about 5 years that if we had dialogues about peace and interfaith understanding, the same five people from each tradition would show up, because those would be the more open-minded, liberal, for lack of a better word, people who were already inclined to believe that, you know, peace could exist and should exist between religions. We were missing large swaths, obviously, of folks. And again, we are not in the same kind of conflict zone that you are, but nonetheless, there are conflicts with a small c. So what we decided to do is to focus, again, on very practical matters from domestic violence, for example, that affects everybody's community, or child health care, or predatory lending, or in the 2008 crash, people were really concerned about bankruptcy and foreclosures were hitting everybody's congregations and houses of worship. And for that issue, the courts became a major institution that really helped us. They were a civic space that were both interested in learning about the religious diversity of our city, and we, as religious leaders, were curious to learn about how our courts work, because they affect so much of our constituency. And then, at that point, when we switched our focus, we began to get, you know, the Sheikh Drama from the West African, you know, communities and Muslim communities in the Bronx, with more Orthodox Jewish leaders from Williamsburg, who actually had this very thing in common with one another. And religion just didn't come up to begin with. However, friendships were formed. And that was actually the key in terms of long-term outcomes. And again, they tend to be quite modest, yet not modest if you happen to be involved in them. So three or four years later, after some of our first roundtables, we found that this, you know, Sheikh Drama and the Solomon Schechter school leaders were taking Muslim and Jewish youth together around the Holocaust, the Museum of Jewish Life downtown, and this came out of a friendship. So that's really been our governing approach, and again, it's always much easier to do on local issues than as soon as you start to get sort of larger, even things like police-community relations, as it, you know, forms some interesting coalitions around Black Pentecostal leaders and Muslim leaders who are all experiencing one form of profiling or another from the police. It's still, you wouldn't get the potential for strange bedfellows somewhat diminished the more high level the political issue got. So by sticking locally, you did get these rather extraordinary friendships. So that's sort of where we are. And then the other thing I wanted to suggest was that we also had the advantage, I think, of early on learning the hard way that if we referred to clerics, to clergy, we would generally only get men showing up at our events. And that when we sort of switched our terminology, we opened ourselves to a whole new group of people with their own very powerful constituencies, because that allowed us in those traditions that did not ordain women. Nonetheless, women, as we know, have been enormously influential and powerful players within religious communities. And I guess that leads to a question that I had in terms of your own book, because I know that in Israel there has been a very strong women's peace movement. You mentioned, you know, the women
waging peace,
but also I know there's Women in Black and Women of the Wall and so forth. But now I'm curious about just your own experience with the Interreligious Coordinating Committee, because I think my guess is that there are not a lot of women who are in outwardly, who are not in clerical positions. And so in my mind, there's a bit of a disconnect in terms of tapping the power of religious women within Jewish, Christian, and Muslim life, and women's peace movements in a sort of more secular thing. So I'd love for you to comment on that. So that's it for the moment for me, but I'd love to talk more later. Okay.
And now we'll ask Iman, and then you can.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here. It's such a pleasure to be in your company and to learn so much about the work that you've been doing. So the thing that struck me most about your book was the central theme of how ignorance really drives a lot of the problems that are in Israel. And I think that that's, and I think that that's right. And I think one of the things that I find as an American Muslim, that is one of the most ignorant things that I learned, actually, was when I met people who were from Israel, who are actually Arab Israelis. And they are much more moderate than the Arabs, you know, some of the Arabs, right? A lot of the Arab activists here, you know, that are doing the work. And it's really incredible, right? And I was really struck by that. And it was, It was just systemic. Every single one of them that I met was like, I don't understand why you all are so, you know, intense over here. Like, I live over there and I have tons of Jewish friends and it's totally fine. So I thought that that was really, that's a really important point that I think maybe I and others who do interfaith work, when we go into these difficult spaces can sort of explain, because I don't live there, but I can tell them, like, I have friends if you want to Skype them and talk to them, because they don't really have the same views as what you're saying. So I think that that was one thing that struck out, that stuck out at me. I also really liked the part about how Arabic, how you said you regretted not learning Arabic. I thought that was really insightful, and that reminds me of my own experiences and how and a hopeful piece, which is that a lot of, you know, Arabs here and overseas as well are learning Hebrew, right? So that's another point of interfaith dialogue, which I was happy to see, because it's easier if, you know, you speak the language, and it also shows, like, that you're trying to really reach out and learn the culture, which is really hopeful. And again, like I said, I see that happening on both sides. There were just so many wonderful stories that you talked about. You know, you talked about how you met the head of Al-Quds University, and how there was the need for a miracle, the political miracle. And you guys have to read the book; it's so good. I love that piece. And I actually had a professor, Professor Kwant, who's actually who worked on the Camp David Accords.
William Quant.
Yeah, William Quant. Yeah, he was my professor at UVA, and he's a really great mentor of mine. So, yeah, I just, the thing that's just, I just love this book because it still brings hope, you know, because I've spoken to so many people over there, overseas, here, and there just seems to be such a, you know, such a sad sort of, a really sad, you know, climate. And I think that we can relate to that here because there seems to be a rise of this really hardline right-wing situation where they're against, not against, but yeah, I think there's a tendency to not want to have a dialogue with the other side. And I see this internationally. It's not just in the United States. And so, my question is, how do we go back to the time of, you know, how do we get, like, the Rabins back and, you know, the Shimon Peres is back? I mean, that's really the thing that is really most heartbreaking is, like, I don't have the answer to that. But I do think that, you know, what you're doing, the grassroots education piece, shows that, yeah, I think most people, everybody should know that most people who live in the area, the context within Israel and within the Palestinian territories want peace. And most people don't actually know that here. So that's a huge thing that I thought was just so well explained. And I think the reason for that is a lot of these informal connections and because, you know, like eat the same food. Like my grandfather's landlady was like a Jewish lady from France. Like it's not, you know. So, in Algeria before, you know, the war and stuff. So I just think, I really just appreciate the approach. I think we at the Interfaith Center, like Chloe said, are very action driven. We're having an academy like that we're putting on. It's called the Interfaith Civic Leadership Academy. And it's again, trying to bring people into the fold that are new immigrants that don't necessarily engage with a lot of other folks from different traditions. And it's 20 different, it's gonna be 20 different people who come from vastly different religions. And also some are very traditional, like a very traditional imam. And then you have like a voodoo priestess who's like, you know, and they're gonna have to, you know, hopefully interact. And that's very important. And then after they get those workshops, you know, we have 20 workshops that they're going to go through. Once they get that knowledge, we're going to have a community-based project that they're going to have to implement because action has to come after after work. So that's a little bit about our model. You already heard that from Chloe, but I just think that the book is great. I don't know what to say. Education is the right way to go, so I don't practice law. So thank you so much. And
thank you.
All right.
So Ron very graciously has asked Chloe and Iman to come up as well so that when people from the audience ask, we can really have some conversation. Oh, you got a chair too? You pay him extra for that. I want to say as well and echo what Chloe and Iman said, that the book is a great read. As I said, I've known Ron forever, and I'm in the business as well and have been doing interreligious dialogue. I just want to say for the record, Ron, that at JTS, the institute that we have has been doing Jewish-Christian dialogue since 1938, and we did come late to Jewish-Muslim dialogue. We only began that in 1956. So, but it's there, and it's real, and all of the things they mentioned about how we integrate and what does it mean and who's at the table and who's not at the table, and the difference in worldview between what Iman and Chloe do, starting with action, versus what I, as an educational institution, and Ron did, starting with dialogue and education. There is a middle ground, and I think that's what we want to hear more about. And also, what Ron, you now are retired, so you have full time to do this work. But please, questions from the audience as well.
Can I react just to
sure.
Just a few things that were said before we open? First of all, with regard to your comments, a question about women and the action first model. So I've always envied the people who do action first. I like the idea. I've never done it. I know other people who've done it, Ibo Patel's work, and Rabbi Bob Kaplan, mm-hmm. JCRC, and but I do have the impression that it's more action and less dialogue, and that we haven't found the middle ground. We did have a problem in Israel, because there are Jewish women rabbis. There are no Jewish women, Muslim women imams. There is the first woman Qadi now in Israel. There's two in Palestine. Which is.
Can you explain what a Qadi is?
A Qadi is a judge, and an imam is like a local rabbi. But in general, the official dialogue, which I'm usually not in because I'm not Orthodox, are all male, when you have clerics. So we got around that by most of the things that we do. Were young people, young adults, educators. Most of the things we did were fully integrated, with the exception that we once did an all-men religious leaders group, and in the same year there was a women's group doing all women things, not with clergy, of course, because there aren't, but with women professionals of different kinds, and it did open it up, and it helped us get beyond the usual five people who were coming to all the meetings. So, thank you for your comments. I just want to react to a few of them. We and other organizations several years ago, doing most of our dialogue groups in Arabic and Hebrew with a translator. Most people don't know both languages. So if you have Palestinians and Israeli Jews, you can either go to English, which is a lot of people do because they're going abroad or whatever, which is makes it culturally elite, or you can do it in the local languages. And then you need a translator, which has the additional advantage of slowing down the dialogue and creating more listening.
Very good.
And we found that within our organization and many other organizations, they're working in NGO world in Israel, more and more, particularly younger people, are learning Arabic. At certain centers where you can learn it in Jerusalem, we're talking about hundreds of people like learning Arabic, spoken Arabic now. And there are many Palestinians, particularly in East, who are learning Hebrew for very practical reasons. Mm-hmm. One of my, I don't know what to call him, a young man named Tariq Saman, who graduated our programs, went to Brandeis for 2 years, got a master's, and now he's back. He's the co-pilot of Kids for Peace in Israel in Jerusalem now. And he studied Hebrew at the Hebrew University and taught Hebrew to Palestinians in North Jerusalem for many years. So that language is very important. Since you mentioned stories, I tell a lot of stories in the book, this is true. I'm a rabbi, after all. A lot of in the encounters, and you mentioned one that you like, so I'll tell the story. It also involves Tom Cahill, our friend. I don't know, 10 years ago or so, I was at an international conference in Palermo, Sicily, southern Italy, sponsored by a fabulous Catholic group called the Community of St. Egidio, which is based in Rome and does great work with the poor in Rome, and they get involved in conflict resolution in different parts of the world. They've had for more than 20 years now, and they call it an annual meeting of peoples and religions. And they invite people from 10 different religions, and they usually go to some European city, and they take over the town square, and they have this fabulous candle lighting ceremony at the end with music. You can imagine in Venice at the Piazza of San Marco. They do fabulous productions. And then they have all kinds of panels. So one day they had a, one morning they had a panel on religion and peace. And they had a rabbi, an imam, and a Christian minister all speaking. And guess what? They were all for it. They all spoke nice words of peace. And I wind up afterwards at lunch with Tom Cahill and this fellow, Professor Sari Nuseba, who, if you don't know the name, was the president of Al-Quds University for many years. And he's a Oxford and Harvard trained philosopher of Islam, not a religious Muslim.
Not everybody knows who Tom Cahill is.
Oh, I'm sorry. Tom Cahill is a famous author, happens to be Catholic, of How the Irish Saved Civilization, and a bunch of other books called Hinges of History, one on the Jews, and one on Jesus, and one on the Greeks, and I don't know. But he's a wonderful guy. He lives in New York, right? A great writer. So, over lunch, we're sitting there, and Tom says to Professor Nesebe, he says, what did you think of this morning's panel? Did you like it? And Nesebe says to him, no. Didn't like it. Why didn't you like it? All these religious leaders, they speak for peace, but what do they do for us really, locally, on the ground? Nothing. They come to Italy and they give a speech for peace, but a bunch of hypocrites. So Kay was a little shocked, because it's not the answer he expected. And he turns to him and he presses on. He says, so Professor Nesebe, what's your solution to the Middle East crisis? And Nesebe thinks for a minute and he does a wink and he says, we need a miracle. Okay, so a few months later that year, at Hanukkah time, I wrote a little article called Time for a Miracle. And I said, when Sadat came to Jerusalem, everybody thought it was a miracle. When Rabin shook hands with Yasser Arafat, who expected that to happen? So, you know, we need a few miracles, God and humans working together. Okay, those are my stories. So, I'll stop there. You want to take questions now? Yes, please. Tell us your name.
David Weiser, and my question is about taking people outside an area of conflict to meet in what
neutral zone.
You can't have to a neutral zone, and then going back to an area of conflict. What experience you've had with an organization like Seeds for Peace, and who else is doing this, and what's your take on what effect that has on how people get along when they get back, and what it does in any degree of conflict resolution over the years after we've returned home?
Okay, please. We'll take a few questions. Who else? Please, tell us your name.
Yeah, I'm Renee Shiro O'Leary. I'm very interested in interfaith for many, many years and working in it. What I'm wondering is, you talk about the different range of Muslims, Christians, and certainly Jews, the intra-faith issues. And to me, that's one of the major problems that we have. That is, one within as well as without. And I'm wondering if you're addressing that in some way, across the spectrum within the Jewish faith, within the Christian faith, within Muslims. Because we all know that the extremist rhetoric gets a lot of press. So I'm curious.
Okay. Would anybody else like to pose the third question? We'll respond to three while you're thinking of more. Yes, tell us your name.
My name is Zina.
Zina?
Yes, Z-I-N-A. I wonder if, particularly in your work in Israel, with Muslim or Palestinians and Jews, the power differential comes up quite a bit, and how you address that in the context of reconciliation and justice.
Okay, that was a big one.
Yeah.
A lot of loaded words there, so we have to think about that. Do you want to say a little more about what you mean?
Jews are in power in Israel. It's a Jewish country. And Palestinians don't have a homeland yet. And that's a sore spot, shall we say, that I would imagine can be tiptoed around.
Okay. All right, so we got three questions so far. Everybody else?
All right. It's a good start.
So far, they're all for me, but feel free to comment on the American experience, too, and feel free to ask my colleagues questions as well. Okay. There used to be a little small cottage industry called the peace business, where the elites would go to Italy and here and there and everywhere for conferences, and they were supposed to come home and change the world, and usually didn't. That's the short answer to your question. The more serious answer is what I tried to do. It's one thing to do it in a nice bubble. You can have a nice conversation. You get to know people. But people found difficulty going home to their communities, which tended to be very against what they were doing. So they were going against the grain on both sides, I think. And they faced difficulty moving, what I call, from the dialogue to the action part. I actually gave a little thought towards the end of my career, and I wrote a little bit about this, I think, in the last chapter two of my book. I think one of our missing links was, I call, the organizational, community organizer type that we needed to help this rabbi or him to go back to his community, because all he knew how to do was give a sermon. He didn't learn at a seminary or wherever he learned it, how to organize his community so that he wouldn't fumble. So I think we missed that piece, and in thinking to the future, I think people need to think about that. But there are lots of things that go on, whether it's Kids for Peace or Hands of Peace or Creativity for Peace or Kids for Peace. There are a number of these programs. Kids for Peace, if you've ever heard of it, is a smaller than Seeds of Peace. It's a wonderful organization. Started with the Anglican Church in Jerusalem, and now it's an independent organization run by Reverend Josh Thomas, who is Anglican. I'm not sure what he is. Huh? It could be. He's a minister. I know that. He studied at Union with my daughter. And it's based out of Washington now, but they work with Israelis and Palestinians locally. And then in the summers, they bring them to camps in America and all kinds of things, and it's growing. And so they are trying to build in this component of what happens after camp.
Another local effort is actually now hosted by Auburn Seminary. It originally began in Denver. It's called Face to Face, where they bring Palestinian young women, Israeli young women, and they bring them here to America for a 10-week summer with American young women at the same age. They put them in camp together, and those women have maintained relations for, the program's been 15 years now. All 15 years worth of alumna keep in touch with one another.
Okay, so that was one thing. Renee's comment about working intra-faith. Okay. So in our part of the world, we wound up doing a lot of, lots of people in the field. Blake Brera, how do I say that? Because we were sort of forced into it. That is to say, with the rise in violence and security issues, it became harder and harder to bring the two together. So we said, well, okay, we can't really meet this year, so we'll go back to our own communities and do what we call uninational work, with the goal of getting back in touch with the other side. Now, the problem with that is that you often don't get back in touch with, because you can always argue that the security problem is there and it just doesn't happen. But I do think it's an important comment and thought, because an awful lot of our work is done by a relatively small amount of people who I thought should see it as their responsibility to go back to their own communities and to try to shake up their own communities. But I'll give you an example. We had face-to-face. We worked with face-to-face. We would send the kids to Auburn every summer, and they'd come home. And I said, every kid ought to go back to his school and, you know, have a school-wide assembly. That seems to be pshita. They're like, obvious. They couldn't do it. They'd go to the principal, oh, no, we can't do that now. What's going on? And so on and so on. So it's very hard to do it. But I think there is a very strong need. And so one of the reasons that I came many times to America with an Israeli-Arab colleague, you said you learned something about my Israeli-Arab colleagues, because I wanted Jews to meet Israeli-Arabs, to know that Israeli-Arabs, even though they have some Palestinian identity, are not the same as Palestinians living in the occupied territories. So intra-communal education work, I think, is also very important. And the last very complicated question by Zina, power differentials. So put it this way. I once heard about a group from L.A. that came to Israel. There was a rabbi and a Sufi Muslim and a Christian, and they were called Children of Abraham or something like that. And I heard about them, and I wrote to the rabbi, "Do you want to get together when you're in Israel?" And he said, "No." I said, "Why? You talk about politics, but the other org, that's like real life, and the other organization, I won't mention his name, they just deal with religion or spirituality, devoid from the dirty stuff. But we don't want to talk about politics, because then we'll fight and we'll argue." So there is that school of thought that says just sort of like detach yourself from politics. I've never terribly been in favor of it. Now, the issue of power differential is there. It's in the context all the time. And the way we try to deal with it this was our effort, and different people have done it different ways. We built groups usually half Palestinian and half Jewish. We didn't do it tri-religion. Now some group, one third Christian, one third. We do half Palestinian and half Jewish. The Jews will be a variety of Jews, and the Palestinians will be, if we could, mostly Muslim and some Christian, reflecting the reality there, but diverse. So that the Palestinians in the group felt equal. There was no... And then we further enhanced that, and when I say we, another group, by having two facilitators in the room, a Palestinian and a Jew. Mm-hmm. Okay, then there was always the tricky question, who's the translator? Is he a Jew who knows Arabic, or a Palestinian who knows Arabic and Hebrew? And can they be 100% neutral? They're supposed to be neutral. But but leaving that aside, so we did as much as we possible to make everybody feel equal, and we kind of trained the facilitators to work on that, to make sure that everybody had their say and it's all. That's the best I can say. Anybody want to comment on any of those points?
Where would you meet?
We met all kinds of places. We met over time, we would try to meet. There's no such thing as neutral turf. There's sort of neutral turf, but not 100%. It's hard to find. So we would often meet one time in a Palestinian venue, let's say in East Jerusalem, and one time in a Jewish venue, and go back and forth. But the truth is, we had a little center in West Jerusalem where Palestinians felt comfortable coming because we created a safe space for them. And so it didn't, for the most of the time, matter all that much. And we would meet in the Galilee and to tell everybody. We met all over the country. Most of our work, I should say, was with Palestinian Arabs who were citizens of Israel and Jews who were citizens of Israel. We did some east-west Jerusalem. We didn't do much in the West Bank. Okay. Any other folks, please?
I wonder if this is, I don't know if there's any parallel at all here, but some of our work has been with the police and with minority communities of different faith traditions here in New York. And always the power differential, the difference between a 30,000 person institution where people carry guns and have a degree of immunity when it comes to, to the being seen in the eyes of our court system. There's a for better or worse, there is a different standard of proof required for the prosecuting of a police officer who shoots a civilian than there is for a different, another civilian shooting a civilian. So that seems to manifest itself in situations where the police ask, for example, can we be present? Can we tell our side of the story? Right, I've been part of a group that has been looking at ways to involve community mm-hmm. in the process of police training or accountability, and part of that has involved a large number of forums. And then the question comes up, can the police be present at those forums? to, you know, be able to tell their experience. And the pushback has always been, no, you know, we see you every single day of the week, and everybody knows your side of the story, and you have a gun to protect your side of the story, and you have a lot of laws to protect your side of the story. So you do not deserve to be on equal footing, and our stories are not equal when we're around around a table. I mean, is that at all what you're referring to? And I don't know you must have versions of that then.
Well, we do, we have lots of that. I get just listening to you talk, I do some work with the conservative yeshiva now, and there are now four groups of rabbis who are studying together, and I take them on a field trip. Usually when they go on field trips, the rules of engagement in Israel is if you go into East Jerusalem, a Jewish group, you need somebody accompanying with you with a weapon. So I said, we don't go into churches with weapons. Sorry, we don't do that. So we've managed to finagle it by having the guy who had the weapon conceal it, and then we got, you know, and there was no issues. But if he had been toting his weapon, we wouldn't have gone in. It's out of respect to the Palestinians on the issue. So the, you know, the security issues are always kind of hovering there. Yeah. Wait, new people.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell us your name.
Nahum. I like to ask the lady if it's common to have a woman imam, and are you in America or in other countries? And you are by, can you give me an example? What is the nature of a meeting like you conduct? And you can tell some stories about the issues that they raise.
Okay.
So thank you for the question. So I think this goes to what Chloe was saying. So in the United States, and at the Interfaith Center in particular, and within the community organizing spaces that we have, which is what he just touched on, activists that work from a faith-based perspective are not, it's not based on your title. So I'm not an imam. My name is Iman, which means faith in Arabic.
Like emuna.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm not an imam, but I consider myself a faith leader. When, you know, masjids welcome me into their masjid, I don't cover, but I still, you know, when I go into the masjid, I cover my hair, of course, because I am going to respect the house of worship, and I am Muslim, and I do pray. But at the end of the day, they recognize that through action, it's not so much the title. It's not because I went to seminary, and, you know, because we don't have it in our religion yet. But the reality is that we don't have seminaries and we don't have imam.
You do have a title because you're an attorney, and that gives you authority.
Yeah, that gives me some authority, but for the faith community, the reason they respect me, it's hard because I'm young and, like, you know, this and that, and I'm a woman, and there is a serious patriarchy, but the reality is the action speaks for itself. I'm an attorney. I use those skills to help faith-based communities achieve social justice. So if you work in the trenches and you do, and everyone knows you, they know Im Abdurrahman, she's like a leader, you know. She might not necessarily be an imam, but like even within Palestinian circles, there's a degree of respect that's given to women. Even if it's not an official title, but she's very active, you can rely on her, she's very, she's somebody of high quality, I guess you could say, and has given a lot to the community. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Can I just add to that a word about credentialing? Hartford Seminary, which is a Christian seminary, Hartford has a chaplaincy program. The result of the chaplaincy program is that they now have 30% of the student body at Hartford are Muslim. And they chose to really emphasize that so that they could get women chaplains.
So they're creating a cadre of women leaders with the title chaplain. The other place that Muslim women, in addition to chaplaincy in law school, is women are getting PhDs in Islamic studies. And they're professors of Islam. And again, that gives them standing in the community. So a lot of different ways are finding, without necessarily attacking or trying to break down the problem of the imamship. But that's changing too, and little by little, just like in the Orthodox community with women rabbis, it will change because that's Islam in America.
You want to say your name?
Yeah, my name is Cornelia. I'm a third-year rabbinical student at JTS, and I'm also with the Milstein Center. My question is with regard to what you were talking about in the United States and with groups. And also, last year as part of rabbinic training, I spent the year in Israel and was with a bunch of different interfaith groups and talked with a bunch of different diverse groups. And often what I see myself and my colleagues facing is a dilemma of often people will say, just stick to Jewish values. Do you know? Like, don't talk about politics. Don't, you know, if you say one thing, if you say another thing, sort of for your own job safety reasons, just stick to Jewish values. You can talk about social justice, you can talk about, you know, all different kinds of things. And my concern is that leads to sort of the same stymied inaction that I think you discussed, Rabbi, and that a lot of people have seen, and a little bit of what you were describing as well of, I wonder if it will ever be possible for, you were saying that when it comes to local issues, it's very effective to and friendships are formed and relationships are developed. Do you see a future in which, moving forward on the larger issues, that there will be eventually, as the center continues in its work and as more people become involved, people will be able to discuss those sort of more global issues, broader issues, because I worry about the elephant in the room and what I see in Jewish-Muslim relations, conversations at least that I've seen, often the thing that isn't discussed is Israel-Palestine, or it isn't some of the more political things that are going on. So I wonder if in the United States you see it moving in that direction.
Well, I can't talk about the whole, you know, I mean, from our perspective, there's always a tension around what are, you know, whether it's police community relations, that's something a certain number of local faith communities care an awful lot about. And I mentioned the interesting alliance between African American, you know, Pentecostal or Baptist communities and Muslim communities around the Community Safety Act that built in more checks and balances and transparency to the NYPD. But we lost people on that issue too. That's not a lot of Buddhist communities or Sikh or, you know, particularly newer immigrants that you know, are have a different kind of relationship, some of them anyway, with the police. I mean, there's still always, you know, with new immigrant communities, there's always the, you know, how much are the police like the police where they just left? How much are they? But there are other communities that very much, I mean, I remember a call, like the mayor's office put together right after, whether it was Eric Garner or somebody, I think, that a lot of religious leaders were on, and it began with, you know, somebody just saying, oh, thank you, you know, we're so glad to the NYPD, they've done such a great job for keeping us safe, and this was like coming, you know, from the heart of someone who was, I think, from a Sikh tradition, or Hindu, and then the rest of the call just like lighting into it. This is yet another example of the, you know, really heinous behavior, and they covered it up. So, I mean, you do lose people. You can't, the more you're going to go out on an issue, the more likely you're going to, so you do, I mean, so part of, I mean, there's always a calculus involved in some sort of political coalition building, which is what I guess I'm trying to distinguish between that and the sort of more of an educational take on how do you provide for your community in the case of preventing domestic violence. Like, no one's going out, when you start to advocate for policies, that's when you sometimes will sort of you know, automatically gain some people and lose some people. So,
I just want to share with you something very interesting about that, because the strongest peace group in Israel right now, if you don't know it, is a group called Women Waging Peace. Have you read about it?
Yes.
In the New York Torah, or what's it called, the New York Times?
Yes. Yeah.
Women Waging Peace tripled in size last year. They had a march last week, 30,000 people there, Jews and Arabs, Palestinians and Israelis. They're really catching on. And there are people from the right and the left. And their interesting policy trick, it's a Kissinger constructive ambiguity trick, is we don't say what peace policy. We don't tell you two state, one state, half a state, three states. We just say, get down to business and do this, really do it. It's very vague on the one hand, but they're attracting people from a very a broad audience, and it's supposed to be working. So it's an interesting way to try to form as much common ground as you can. And it's fascinating to know that the only live peace group in Israel now is Women Waging Peace.
Wow,
so
that's amazing.
I want to close this because I do want to have an opportunity for Ron to sell and sign books. I want to start by saying that we've been really incredibly privileged to have three religious activists leaders, not just leaders, activists. Iman Bukadun, Chloe Breyer, and especially my teacher, Ron Kronisch. And I'm very grateful all three of you are here to share a very intimate view of your work with this small audience. And so I'm grateful. And I hope you can all share with me a little applause with them. I also want to say, apropos Women Waging Peace, that on our November 8th panel, the lead panelist is Carol Gilligan, who is literally just back from Israel, where she was one of the marchers and speakers at Women Waging Peace. So we'll have the opportunity to hear her. Ron will be sitting here. Again, he is selling his book, $30. That's at discount, because you're at JTS. And I thank you, Ron, for coming all the way from Israel just for us and the nine other book groups that you're doing. Chloe and Iman, we work together all the time. I'm truly blessed to have you as colleagues. And I hope that we will see you in the audience at our other programs as well. Thank you very much.
Okay. Good night to meet you. Good luck. Good luck.